You're listening to a Stranger podcast, www.thestranger.com.
Hi, this is Jen Graves, and you're listening to Invisible, the Stranger's Conversation with People in Art. I'm at Seattle Art Museum, and I'm here with the Anne M. Barwick Curator of American Art, Patty Junker. Hi.
Hello.
We are going to talk today about Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, American Art from the Yale University Art Gallery, which is an exhibition that's on the fourth floor of the Seattle Art Museum, a special exhibition that's here almost through the end of this month, May. The exhibition is very big. It's a very large exhibition, and it essentially covers what you could consider sort of the formation of the nation. There are objects from sort of paintings to furniture to, all
silver,
metals,
prints,
cartoons, political cartoons, and just to go down a quick list, the center, I think of as one of the central artists of the show is John Trumbull, whose 1792 painting General George Washington at Trenton is here, but also so are many of his miniatures that are really interesting, and also the drawings for his series of history paintings about the founding, also of the country. There are works by unknown artisans. I think of a very small children's chair from a Louisiana artisan, and there are also paintings by just sort of the pantheon of artists that you would know if you spent even a little time looking into American art. Thinking of William Sidney Mount, Edward Hicks, Thomas Eakins, Charles Wilson Peale, John Singleton Copley, Winslow Homer, Henry Osawa Tanner, cartoons by Thomas Nast, paintings by Frederick Remington, landscapes by Kensett, Bierstadt, Church, Martin Johnson Heade, and even Teapot by Paul Revere, I think. So there's a lot of material here that is, there are also, I should say, one of the more interesting chapters of the exhibition, too, is the contrast between that material and photographic material. So there are actually photographs by Timothy O'Sullivan, Carlton Watkins Yosemite works are here. So it's a really rich overview. When you're dealing with an overview, you're dealing with a lot of, obviously, the material that has been culled and considered the very best material. How do you, though, get to a new place with it? How do you present something new? How do you explain why it's connected to this particular moment in history?
Well, it's interesting. It's not an easy answer because it is Yale University's collection. So when you say it's an overview, first of all, culled from a collection. From a particular collection that is one of the largest, one of the richest in historical American art in our country. And so it reflects really one collection only. And when you said, an overview of the best, it is certainly that. It also is an overview that takes us into different directions where you might not think about something as representing a great work of art, so much as it is maybe a great historical document. I think particularly about some of the popular prints, the city views. And so those things were included really to be great historical documents. The way the exhibition has been organized has really been thematically to show us there are really two exhibitions here, one of which is a survey of 250 years of political history. You go through that section of the exhibition, that half of the exhibition, you cross the hallway and you start all over again in the 17th century and you look at cultural and material aspirations. So you get art history. You get a look at political, social, and cultural history in one half of the show, and you get a look at art history in the second half of the show. So there is that part of the story, which is new. I think a recognition that you can't do any one thing easily in a single arc, that it really, there's so many threads in American history, and it happens that in this show we're able to do two. It could be so many more, as you know. But we've got these two threads going now, which allows us to tell two very different stories, I think.
Mm-hmm. And John Trumbull makes an interesting sort of headliner in that, because in his self-portrait, he's got his brushes and his hand on his sword.
Right.
And so you're seeing kind of the cultural and material and the political. And there's also an interesting quote that opens the exhibition from John Adams.
Yeah, that's the best.
And I'd like to read that. I have the catalog here, and David McCullough wrote the opening essay. And John Adams wrote to his wife Abigail when he was in Paris in 1780, and the war was going on here. He wrote, "I must study politics and war that my sons may have the liberty to study mathematics and philosophy. My sons ought to study mathematics and philosophy, geography, natural history, naval architecture, navigation, commerce, and agriculture in order to give their children a right to study painting, poetry, music, architecture, statuary, tapestry, and porcelain." And in a sense, you get the same sense from the exhibition, where you travel from the political history into an aesthetic kind of world, into a world full of aesthetic considerations, especially at the very end of the exhibition.
Yeah, if there had been some way to turn that quote into a title, it would have been the perfect the perfect title for this exhibition, because Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness doesn't quite get us where John Adams does. And I think that's what's so wonderful. We can now see in retrospect the evolution that Adams predicted that would take place, that you've that this moment of kind of war and conflict, and then leading of course to peace would lead to enlightenment and prosperity would lead to culture. So he recognized that this was the thrust of history, that it was not about kind of the development of one political ideal, or he really saw that the thrust of history was going to be this flowering of through enlightenment of culture.
How is John Trumbull a central figure, other than in ways that are sort of obvious?
Well, it's very interesting. I tell people when I lecture about the show that the Trumbull paintings at Yale are arguably the reason that this exhibition is traveling. And there's a very interesting story behind that. Yale was founded in 1832 through a gift of the works of John Trumbull. All of the pictures that you see in the exhibition constitute the core collection that he gave to Yale in 1832. So you could say that Yale's art gallery was founded as a museum of contemporary American art, but it was one artist's art in 1832. Now, he was really kind of the great granddaddy of American art in 1832. He had an international reputation. He had come to the end of his career. He had created his life's work, and he was looking for a public institution for it. He had a relative who was the president of Yale and negotiated a deal where he would give his great body of work, the historical pictures that you see in the show and the miniature paintings that led up to them, he would sell these to Yale essentially in exchange for an annuity of $1,000 a year to the end of his life. Now, he lived for some 15 years after he gave the collection in 1832, so he lived a good long time. Yale invested a lot in the Trumbull paintings. He wanted them not just to hang in academic paintings. He was from Connecticut, by the way, from an esteemed Connecticut family. The Trumbulls. Trumbull had been the colonial governor of Connecticut. So he having them at Yale, having them in New Haven, Connecticut, made sense for him. He didn't want them, though, just to be in the academic buildings, which is what I think is so interesting. He insisted that they be seen as art, and he insisted that Yale build an art gallery that he would design. So he designed the first gallery, the Trumbull Gallery, which no longer exists, that building. But he did design that, and he essentially planned the installation of his works there. So it was a real installation piece. There were other provisions, too. He and his wife had to be buried underneath the art gallery, which they were, and they still are. But the other provision, which has been so defining in terms of the way we deal with American art, is that he said that the works of art could never be the term he used was alienated from New Haven. They could never be off of you in New Haven. They couldn't be separated from this installation that he designed in New Haven. And if they ever were, his will dictated that the entire collection would then revert to Trumbull's alma mater, which was not Yale, but was Harvard. So, as a result, that core group of paintings, shown the way he intended them to be shown, has always been seen only in New Haven and has never, ever left and will never, ever leave again. They have a one-time legal dispensation to travel them. But in some ways, I think the installation of the collection was really determined by how to present the Trumbulls and to be true to Trumbull's vision. And I love the installation that we've been able to do to show the sort of process of working from miniature paintings of these historical figures, paintings done from life, to then the theatrical paintings that recreate these historic moments in the Revolution, and then finally to the crowning achievement, the large full-size portrait of Washington at Trenton, which was not a part of the original gift, but was there at Yale. So you get a whole kind of thrust about Trumbull. But I think designing a historical show was in some ways dictated by the fact that you had this big story to tell about the Revolution and a big story to tell in Trumbull's terms. So as a result of Trumbull's wishes, you can never do a show of American history painting or really 18th century portraiture, because Trumbull was really the greatest. And those works can never travel, not even individual works. I mean, you can't just borrow one Trumbull from Yale. None of them can ever leave Yale. And the other great thing is, of course, these works of art that are our cultural touchstones are at, are only ever seen in New Haven, and unless you're in New Haven, you don't get to see them. Now, we know the later works because four of the historical paintings, and there were eight from the Revolution, four of them are in the U.S. Capitol. He was able to get the government to commission four of the murals for the rotunda of the Capitol, Statuary Hall. And you may remember during the Obama inauguration, the luncheon that day, they were in front of four murals, not the Trumbulls, four others, but in that same space. So if you've been to the Capitol, you've seen them. But boy, those works don't hold a candle to the originals that Trumbull did. He started them in London. He took that canvas, for instance, of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. He took it to Paris, and in Thomas Jefferson's house in Paris, he painted Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, and Thomas Jefferson from life directly onto that canvas. So when you see those men in that picture, and you know they were painted from life, it's quite a direct experience, I think, of a moment in history that doesn't seem terribly proximate to us because we don't have photography as a record of what of who these men were, what they actually looked like. Mm-hmm. So they're very spine-tingling for me. Mm-hmm. You know, you feel like you really are in the presence of living mm-hmm. people, that these men actually did live.
Well, and I like your take that in many ways this collection is a contemporary art collection, at least at the time it was, much of it was formed.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interested in your take. I've talked on this podcast with artists Titus Kafar and Corin Hewitt, who also have exhibitions, who are living artists,
mm-hmm.
who have exhibitions up at, in the museum right now. What's your take on the connections that those shows have or make with this show?
Oh, it's a very interesting question. You know, one of the things I keep reminding people when they look at historical American art is to remember that it was all contemporary art once. And so I think remembering that each one of these artists was responding to political issues and cultural issues and aesthetic issues that were really, uppermost in the minds of at least the intelligentsia in their day, that in some ways they're really not unlike. If you could imagine that Corin Hewitt and Titus Kafar have these sort of political issues that they address up front, One of the things that I've learned from looking at contemporary art is that, oh my goodness, you know, John Trumbull was probably not all that different. And so trying then to put historical art in contemporary, in social and political context is very important for me. I have found that really the way to get inside the artist's mind is not to deal so much with the formalist issues, but to really get at these, the same issues that compel artists today to express themselves. So given that, how do you deal with Trumbull? How do you deal with Trumbull's politics? Well, one of the things that I think is very interesting is that those pictures are not so propagandistic as you might think. When you know, imagining an American celebrating issues in the American Revolution, he took several episodes where the American effort failed. The Battle of Bunker's Hill, for instance. We'll start with that one. One of the most beautiful pictures in this series. There are several battlefield pictures, two of which were not American victories. The point of the picture really kind of hinging on the way the sort of victor and the defeated and how they treated each other, and the fact that you really do get a sense when you're looking at these pictures that you were looking at a battle. Brother against brother, and they're not as sort of clear cut, easy to understand, good guys, bad guys, which is of course one of the whole political construct of this revolutionary period, is that you couldn't easily determine who was a loyalist and who was a revolutionary. Everybody had a practical reason to side one way or another, but the battle was brother against brother, how you behaved on the battlefield, how you determined what was a worthy victory, depended upon your gentlemanly behavior on that. How did you behave toward your enemy? And you'll see, for instance, in the Battle of Bunker's Hill picture, that one of the grenadiers is bent on using his bayonet in the chest of an officer, and the British officer is stopping him. In other words, I think about this today, torture won't get you anything. It's a cheap shot. And so how can you have a noble victory when you have behaved less than nobly? And I think there's a lesson in there still that resonates today.
That's really interesting. And the politics, too, and the way that the sort of brother versus brother, the way that complicates the narrative in interesting ways. Isn't that also, can you talk a little bit about John Singleton Copley and his politics, and also his politics in relationship to his friend Elliot Gardner?
I know. Well, this is what I think is, so, you know,
we have to say, just so people know, Elliot Gardner is the subject of his painting that's at the top of the stairs.
That's right, in the permanent collection of the Seattle Art Museum. I would love to do an entire seminar on the revolutionary period, focusing on that one painting of Dr. Gardner. And I'll tell you, it is really, really complicated. I tell people this when we're looking at the Yale show. There are three marvelous Copley portraits in this building right now. You can see two of them in the Yale show, Mr. and Mrs. Isaac Smith, and then you can see Dr. Gardner in the third floor galleries. Now, if you were to imagine who was the most English by the kinds of material goods that they surrounded themselves with, and the kind of attitude that they exhibited, I think you would say Mr. and Mrs. Isaac Smith were certainly aspiring to be the English aristocracy. And they were, and yet they were relatives of John Adams, and they were revolutionaries. Now you look at Dr. Gardner. He's about as spare and simple and straightforward and Yankee as can be, and yet he was a loyalist. And the reasons that people chose one side or another was not because they were good or not because they were bad, as I said, but because they had practical reasons. Copley, for instance, painted both. He did a terrific painting of Sam Adams. He did John Hancock. He did Sam Adams protesting with the Stamp Act. He understood the political debate. He happened to be married to Mr. Richardson, who was the one man granted the right by the crown not to have to pay tax on imported goods. So when all of that tea was thrown into Boston Harbor to protest the tax on imports, it was Dr. Richardson's tea that was being thrown overboard. And Copley knew that for the sake of family, he needed to leave the country. So he had, I'm sure, political reasons for supporting one stand or another. But he had practical reasons for wanting to maintain this association with the crown. Mm-hmm. Everybody did. Every single person did. Dr. Gardner is a perfect example. He was born in this country. He was educated in Scotland, educated in Paris in medicine. But in colonial Boston, his principal clientele was the British Navy. He was also extremely pious, and his association again with the crown came about because of his association with the Church of England. And so he was granted a land grant by the crown to build churches and to settle communities through in rural New England with immigrant families. And so he would build the church, he'd get the Episcopal minister, and he would make it possible for immigrant families to settle in rural New England. And so his association, I think, was less political than it was religious. Mm-hmm. And through his medical practice. Mm-hmm. So there are infinite reasons, mm-hmm, I found. And it's not an easy narrative to tell.
It's interesting to have an exhibition that brings up questions of right and wrong, but doesn't sort of, yeah, simply answer them. And another figure who is not a contemporary artist, but another problematic figure that I'd love to hear your take on, is in another of the galleries, George De Forest Brush.
Oh, yes. Oh, thank you.
So there is an exhibition of his Indian paintings made, I think, between 1891 and 1890.
Between 1882 and 1890.
And 90, right. And he, George De Forest Brush, an exhibition co-organized with the National Gallery of Art, mm-hmm, and Seattle Art Museum, He traveled the country, Florida. I'm trying to think of where else.
He was in the West.
Places,
yes,
right?
he went west in 1882. He was in Montana and Wyoming. And then, of course, in Europe.
So he spent all of this time, and in particular, I'm thinking of his going down to Florida, mm-hmm, and seeing, mm-hmm, imprisoned Apache, mm-hmm, people, mm-hmm, who were also just starving and living in these terrible conditions. And his paintings, when this exhibition was in D.C., there was a really interesting review written about it, about his kind of practice of romanticizing his subjects, and that there's this sort of a sort of double project that he's doing, in the way that I see it, and that he's bearing witness in a sense by being there, but at the same time he's sort of also dehumanizing his subjects, yeah, by turning them into these symbols. He ends up making these very romanticized paintings, mm-hmm, that are really interestingly problematic,
yeah,
because they're these lone figures. The figures are often interacting with, say, a rare bird, who the bird itself is the subject of controversy at that time, because, yeah, the birds were going extinct in order to make women's hats have bird feathers. So there's this equivalence there between the extinction and the abuse and extinction.
Yeah.
Of these animal populations and these native populations. And so, how do you read his paintings?
Well, it's a wonderful question, and I have lots to say about it, and we've written 300 pages on 21 pictures. So, but this is where I would say I started kind of appreciating his realism. But realism for the sake of realism has never been enough for me, and it shouldn't be enough for any of us. And what I really wanted to do again was to kind of study the context, the circumstances of the artist, the political and social leanings, if you will, of the artist, and then the kind of value of his poetic treatment became clear to me. If you take the pictures at face value, I think our minds are apt to say, oh my goodness, you know, they're not true to the subject. They're these theatrical, fanciful, Victorian pictures of naked Indians that certainly don't show them in their condition. Now, he was aware that there were artists who were taking kind of documentation as their mission, particularly George Catlin. He never intended to be George Catlin. I think in some ways he thought, well, that's being done. Somebody else is doing that. But I think the choice that he made is the difference between, say, an artist who chooses, or a writer who might choose journalism versus poetry. And I would say that Brush was certainly the poet. And I think rather than kind of recording the issue of the moment, he's really thinking about larger sensations that are timeless and always evocative and provocative, so that looking at those pictures, we can get something, I think, even more touching out of them than just simply kind of turning away from what were really the unutterable conditions of American Indians. And he saw that and he hated it. But he addressed his feelings about it, and he wasn't painting for patrons, by the way. He's painting for himself. He's compelled to paint these pictures in a certain Victorian language, which is very oblique and symbolic and metaphorical. And I think one picture in particular, which for me is so very touching, is the Indian and the Lily. And this is where, when you peel away the layers and you build the context around that picture, I think you begin to see how complicated his mind was and what he brought to this picture. It's the picture of an Indian by himself in a Florida swamp. As I said, all the pictures were done by 1890, and this is one of the last ones in the group of pictures. He had, as you said, gone to Florida. He had gone to, hopefully, to paint Geronimo before he learned that Geronimo was not being kept in the prison in Florida, but was elsewhere in the state. He was not being kept in St. Augustine. I should back up and say that the whole reason that the Apaches got to Florida is because the medicine man Geronimo, and a small band of his followers had managed to escape the confinement for so long. And the U.S. Army was really kind of, you know, worried about this because Geronimo was on the loose, and they put all of the resources of the U.S. Army and most of the resources of the Mexican Army toward capturing Geronimo and these men. And it's in these battles, this attempt to capture Geronimo and sequester him and his men became known popularly in the mid-1880s as the Apache Wars in the Southwest. I mean, it was just such a lopsided battle, the whole U.S. Army against this small group of men. And Geronimo realized he was really just revolting against containment. He you know, was sort of fighting for these lands in the Southwest that had always been theirs in both Mexico and the Southwest United States at that point. So he finally surrendered, and he said, okay, have it your way. Just we'll live here. We will agree to live here on our ancestral lands in the Southwest. Well, then as something that can only be described as an act of just tremendous cruelty on the part of the U.S. government, they packed all the Apaches up, or a whole bunch of the Apaches, put them on trains, and sent them to a prison in St. Augustine, Florida, in what was essentially a concentration camp. Many of them died en route. I mean, it's just a horrible moment. And Brush goes down there, I think, kind of understanding the significance of this event, really the slaughter, you might say, of a whole population of people. So out of his experience among the Apaches came a picture like The Indian and the Lily, which is a lone Indian bent in reaching down into the swamp toward a water lily, which he can't quite grasp. And the whole point, I mean, you could look at it and say, yes, it's this, you know, primeval man in a primeval world, and he is something other than a contemporary being, you know, a contemporary man, and he is one of the others, and he's in this remote, indeterminate place. And But what I think is so touching is that there are references clearly in the picture, the Apache leggings, for instance, that everybody who looked at that picture would have understood, I think, the reference, I mean, if not necessarily the pointed comment about the state of the Apaches, I think they would have appreciated the poetic statement that he was making about the impossibility of grasping the ideal, because that reaching for the lily was a Victorian, it was really current in Victorian thought, it was handed down in a very popular Victorian novel, which was read in this, it was part of the canon of literature through the 1950s, I think, and everybody knew this story. A story of reaching for a water lily, which on the surface is such a beautiful and easily attainable ideal. But the water lily has beneath it this this dark, sinister nets. The roots of the water lily are these really long tendrils. And so in this particular Victorian narrative, a young man reaches for the water lily and he gets wrapped up in the nets, and he's taken down, down, down in the water and almost is drowned until he breaks loose and comes through and realizes that you can never attain the ideal because you tempt death in even trying. And I see this Indian reaching toward the water lily, knowing that the popular Victorian narrative tells everyone the moral is you can't reach for the ideal, you tempt death in even trying. And I think it is a really touching poetic statement, using the best language I think that Brush knew how to use to really make this story resonate, this timely political story resonate. He had such hopes for that picture. Even after he stopped painting Indians in 1890, he went back eventually to that picture. He painted it again. He allowed it to be used in popular reproductions 3 times. It was published by a publisher who produced prints for American classrooms. And so it was a picture that people knew. It was a really popular picture, and he wanted it that way. And I think he really felt that its message was resonant.
That's really interesting. When he only painted these Indian paintings, he really only painted Native Americans for 8 years.
Right.
Why do you think he sort of decamped? Ended up going to Florence.
He did, and it's a very interesting story. We don't really have an answer. We have a couple of things to consider in trying to answer it. One is that his dealer, New York dealer, Noedler Gallery, knowing that there was a market for Orientalist subjects in the Near East, and that Brush had been a student of Jean-Léon Gérôme in Paris, who was the great painter of these Orientalist fictions, that knowing that there was a market for that, they offered to pay Brush a subsidy to paint pictures like Gérôme. Well, he said, okay, I'll try this, but it didn't. He just couldn't connect with that subject. It wasn't right for him, and he, you know, good for him, gave it up before he ever really got started. And so there's that issue. We know that there was a very clear motivation. But I do think that this experience of dealing with fellow human beings who were so now out of their place and out of their time was extremely difficult for him. You know, he ends up, one of the last pictures in the group is, he writes to a friend and says, you know, I found the way to make the most expressive pictures, and that is to take all of the setting away and to show the lone Indian. And I think by doing that, he really does force us to see that this Indian is now a human being without place and without time and without context. And I think for him it is a sad commentary.
He sort of becomes overwhelmed by the ability to to bear this witness.
Yes, exactly. And that's it. That is exactly what I think happened. He realizes in the 1930s people are really keen to get back to his pictures. I did find an interesting thing that happened in the collecting of his paintings. You know, he was painting these things between 1882 and 1890. For him, they had so much poetic resonance. They were a way of kind of reminding us of the horrible ideals of the modern world in so many ways. But his realism, his intense realism, this kind of magic realism, I think of them as kinds of pictures that remind me of those little scenes that I used to see in the Viewmaster, the little Viewmaster stereo viewer that we had as children. There were these kind of miniaturist worlds. Well, critics said that his intense realism kind of deprived them of their poetry, you know, in the way that, say, his contemporaries Abbot Thayer or Thomas Wilmer were doing with their ethereal subjects that seemed to be so clearly of another imagined poetic realm, that Brush's intense realism kind of denied his subjects their poetry, their poetic meaning. But the next generation, interestingly enough, so the people who are collecting his pictures are contemporary art collectors, and you don't find them saying, "I love the way you've painted the Indian. I appreciate the politics." You don't get that out of those collectors. You get, you know, poetry, the academic ideal, the beautiful rendering of the human form. Those are the kinds of things that his contemporaries are bringing to the appreciation of these pictures. But the next generation, when they realize what we have done to this race of people, and they realize that Brush was there and he was close for all of his departure from reality, they then begin to sort of look to the to the details in the pictures, and so you find that the next generation of people who collect them are actually ethnographers, interestingly enough. So the focus completely changes once the hard reality has set in.
Mm-hmm. You know, all of these questions and the question of ethnography starts to come up because, and I think it's all of these things are a series of questions that Seattle Art Museum has been engaged in various ways in the past maybe 10 years. Mm-hmm. You know, you are curator of American art. There is also, however, a curator of Native American art.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, there's also a curator of African art. And there also are African contemporary artists in the African collection. There also are this show of 19th century American American Native American paintings is near contemporary Native American works.
Right.
And I'm wondering if there's a way that you can talk about your approach to developing Seattle Art Museum's American program, given a kind of determination to be aware of these issues.
One of the things that I'm really interested in is everything that's happening in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the idea that I have a colleague who, because so much 19th century American art has to do with the West. I mean, we find this in the Yale show. And one of the nice things about having the Brush show here is that it's a chapter that is not represented in the Yale show. And then if you go through the Yale show looking at 19th century things, you will not find many depictions of Native Americans, which is kind of an anomaly because all 19th century American art, so much 19th century art is about the West. And, of course, you can't paint the West unless you paint the encounters. And so what I'm finding so wonderful is to have ways of reading these encounters and understanding these encounters, which has opened my eyes tremendously. One of the things, for instance, we're doing, thanks to an insight that Barbara shared with me.
Barbara Brotherton,
our curator of Native American art. I have a new reading of Bierstadt, for instance. We have a Bierstadt painting of Puget Sound. We laugh at that painting because we know it's a fiction. And it's just about as wild and crazy a landscape as you could imagine. And those of us who live here, we sort of recognize the spirit of the place, but it doesn't look at all like Puget Sound, really.
And he painted it before he came here.
And he painted it before he came here. That's what I was going to say. He painted it in 1870, and we know that he had not been here. But so one day I was giving a lecture on this, and I went to Barbara thinking, well, okay, if he's made up the landscape. What does it tell us about the natives who are in it? Because it is also the central figures in the picture, little tiny figures, but right at the center of the landscape are a whole population of native fishermen. And so I went to her one day while I was writing this lecture, and she said, and she just was able to tick off every object in the picture and saying, this is a this, and this is a this, and this is a this, distinguishing even among the bows of the canoes. So I thought, well, my goodness, I had known that Bierstadt was an avid collector, I guess you could say, of Native American material. Not that he really knew what he had, I don't think, in the way a scholar of that material would, but he had a huge Native American collection. But that had burned when his studio burned in the 1880s, and so it never occurred to me that there would be anything left, but we knew that he had large Native collections, and I should have thought, well, of course, he would have had Northwest Coast material, too. But we actually were able to find, because Barbara got me thinking about this, why is the Native American material accurate and the landscape, when the landscape is clearly a fiction? And knowing that no photographer at this period of time in the 1860s was doing the kind of documentation, you might say, that somebody like Curtis was doing a generation later, Edward Curtis, I began to see where could he have gotten these objects. And I, lo and behold, on a lark, I looked, I contacted the archives of the American Museum of Natural History in New York, and boom, there are 59 objects that Mrs. Bierstadt gave when her husband died, and most of them are Northwest Coast, and many of them are the objects in this painting, including the exact model canoe that you can see in the middle of the picture, and other model canoes. So then, now I reread that picture. I reread the truth of that picture is about the history of this region. It's not about the fanciful look of the place so much as it is about the venerable ancient mariners who lived here, ancient fishermen and ancient mariners. And of course, you know, I've known this about Bierstadt. I knew that he had a real sort of reverence for history, but you don't get it often as dramatically or as clearly, I think, as you do in this picture that we have here. So now I read this as a kind of reverent history picture rather than just a kind of funny, fanciful landscape. And that all came about because of the conversation that takes place between the Native American object curator and myself, and the realism or lack thereof is part of the conversation that really opens my eyes to the way the 19th century viewed Native Americans.
You know, you brought up when you were talking about Yale the fact that it's impossible to do, say, a total 18th century portraiture show, for instance, since those paintings can't leave Yale by John Trumbull. And I wanted to ask about the difficulty of developing an American art collection in a city like Seattle. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to, I suppose, in particular, bring up the example of, you know, that Seattle sometimes gets objects that, like maybe this Bierstadt painting, are interesting for different reasons than you might expect, or odd for reasons that have yet to be developed, or reasons that we do know. And one of those objects is the Louis Sullivan that recently was acquired.
Yes.
And that Louis Sullivan elevator facade that came in just, I think, at the end of March was hung at the end of March, and is actually a collage of pieces from elevator facades from the Chicago Stock Exchange from the third floor up to the 13th floor. And this is a pasting together, or I imagine welding together, of various of those parts to create a new piece from history. which is really quite interesting. So I wondered if you could talk
a little bit. Well, I don't want to steal the thunder of my colleague Julie Emerson, our Ruth Nutt curator of American decorative, curator of decorative arts, not just American decorative arts, and she's the one who was responsible for finding it and acquiring it and installing it.
And
so
and it's in her office that we are right
we
now.
We are in her office. And so I don't want to sort of head in a direction that is really her expertise. But it is, you know, all we have of the Stock Exchange really are these remnants of these elevator facades now, which were really quite a wonderful architectural design. So anybody who wants to create the effect of that elevator screens really can't, and they were such a wonderful part of his overall design of the Stock Exchange. So I guess as sort of the last things that exist, it has that it has such importance in that way. It's a magnificent object just in terms of, you know, it's so funny when you mention it being put together from parts, and I think the wonderful thing is that it is a his design is almost an assemblage of parts. You know, there's the sort of screen, which feels very much like wire, and then there are the components that are cast bronze or are multiple metals, and it, in a kind of layering of things. So in a way, this reassembly makes perfect sense because it is true to the way he imagined these screens himself. So they really replicate exactly what he did architecturally, if not to the letter.
Mm-hmm. And the building was demolished in 70s?
Yes, I think so.
76, perhaps?
Yeah.
And so this, you know, is a kind of rarity put together. Do you actually know how it was put, who put it together, where it was put together?
I don't. I will find out. I'm sorry, everyone who's listening.
Yeah,
Julie Emerson is on a sabbatical right now, and she can and one can get this answer from her. I'm afraid I'm just not the expert here to be able to talk about that.
Tune in later.
Yeah, the interesting thing that I would say about that elevator screen, if you come to see it, I think it would be a surprise to all of you because I think of Louis Sullivan as being kind of a proto-modern. I mean, he was proto-modern. I think of him as, you know, because he trained Frank Lloyd Wright, and I sort of think of them as being such like-minded people. The wonderful thing about this elevator screen is that it seems so Victorian in a way. Mm-hmm. It has some wonderful Victorian elements. And then you realize that it predates our sculpture by Augustus St. Gaudens. And I think it's a real kind of, you know, aha moment when you think about Victorians dealing with this newfangled thing, the elevator.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has its kind of wonderful Victorian architecture laid over industrial design.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny you say that. I was I think it's a T in the center with a lot of very small detailed carvings. It's reminiscent of some of the Masonic objects.
Well, isn't that interesting? You know, they look very Art Nouveau to me.
Yeah.
And they also remind me of what St. Gaudens was doing in relief sculpture. Mm-hmm. You know, that very low relief that, is, you know, very Roman feeling. Mm-hmm. So it seems so much a Victorian construct to me now, even though the symbols that he's using are his own kind of reference. You know, they don't have a source in antiquity or Japanese or any direct source. They really are his own invention, and in that way they are modern.
Well, we're running out of time, but really quickly, can you give us some idea of what's coming up in the American Department at CLR?
I can. You know, one of the well, one of the things that we can do best here is because we have some really astute collectors in this city, and what we were able to do, for instance, with the promised gift of Barney Ebsworth last fall, with bringing together important Edward Hopper paintings to put his promised gift of a great Edward Hopper painting in context, is I want to do more things like that, and to show people to really build on the strengths that are here, and also to introduce these works in some kind of context so that you can really understand how important they are in history and how important they are to Seattle, and really kind of connect some dots around them, because, you know, when they do come to us, they'll be hanging in isolation, and you won't be able to sort of see why is 1929 Hopper so important without kind of telling the story when you unveil it. So one of the things that I want to do, which isn't on the calendar yet, but is a project that I propose doing along the same lines, building on a gift that Barney Ebsworth has already made to us, Georgia O'Keeffe's great painting, Music, Pink and Blue, Number 1, which is one of the great misunderstood paintings in American art. Mm-hmm. So I've decided that I would like to show it in the context that she created it and do a show called O'Keeffe in Music, because that's a painting that really is about music and about the visualization of musical tones and rhythms. But it's a painting that, and so when she painted it in 1919, it related to a series of musical abstractions that she was working on. But when it was shown in 1924, it was the painting that Alfred Stieglitz recast as a sexual representation, a manifestation of her sexuality in a very direct way, and sort of tried to create a buzz about her and her work by misrepresenting the picture in this other way that she said humiliated her. So in a sense, it was the defining picture. It's the picture that everybody, you know, now refers to when they talk about O'Keeffe as the quintessential woman artist dealing with her sexuality. But its source was really in another, with another body of work. So I'd like to show it with that other body of work and really expand upon the whole idea of visualizing music. Mm-hmm. So those kinds of focus shows are what we can really do to bring out these great things that will one day be ours and to unveil them in context. Mm.
And I'm thinking there's a Joseph Stella that's coming in from Barney Ebsworth. That huge, amazing thing.
Well, you know,
I really hope that gets some very good attention.
Well, I have to tell you, this is another one of the projects that I proposed doing.
What is the title of that painting? I can't remember.
The exact title has gone out of my head, but it refers, it's a very kind of Garden of Eden, enormous picture. Well, here's the interesting thing. Joseph Stella, as you said, again, kind of unveiling things in context. It is this very mystical picture, and it very early in the teens, an enormous picture. And what is so interesting about that, which art historians, a few art historians know, but the rest of the world doesn't, is that its companion piece was one of the Brooklyn Bridge pictures. So it is part of a pair of a precisionist picture of the Brooklyn Bridge, and then this this mystical, you know, Edenic view of nature.
Wow.
And so bringing the two of them together and dealing with them as a pair, because they've never been shown as a pair.
Oh,
I think not since they were originally painted. So dealing with the two forces that have always run through this man's work, but there they are. They're working simultaneously upon him and not in some kind of linear way.
Wow.
So that's a great thing if we could do that. I mean, we can do so many wonderful projects that I think advance scholarship in American art, even though we don't have the objects physically in the building all the time.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about some of this.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you for listening. You've been listening to Invisible.